Welcome to this special spin-off audio program on the management of brain metastases in patients with non-small cell lung cancer that was developed following a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 Society for Neuro-Oncology Annual Meeting in Phoenix, Arizona. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Gregory Riley, who participated in our symposium, to review the topics and cases discussed at the meeting, including audience polling data, and to obtain his perspectives on the integration of novel therapies into the management of patients with non-small cell lung cancer and CNS metastases. To begin, I asked Dr. Riley for his perspective on one of the survey questions we posed to a group of neuro and community-based oncologists. One of the things we asked these oncologists, these are typical general medical oncologists, how many patients with metastatic lung cancer are in your practice? And the median was about 50, which at first blush seems unbelievable. You know, that seems like a huge, huge number. But actually, when you multiply by number of oncologists, it actually makes sense. I think it's right. I mean, and I guess my question to you is, first of all, are you surprised to hear that?
I think the key factor, of course, is, you know, incidence prevalence. You know, it's just like we dealt with CML long ago. CML was once a rare disease, and now we've turned things around a little bit. And so I think, you know, you can imagine if you include those ALK-positive patients, those EGFR mutant patients that are remaining in a practice 3-4 times as long as what the patients 5 years ago did, I think that probably does sort of jive with reality. And of course, I also feel like medical oncologists in the community really feel comfortable managing these patients now, whereas a few years ago, they weren't exactly sure which drugs to use when, and so they felt a little bit more like they wanted to send those patients off to some other place. But now they really fit in their practice. Those docs feel comfortable, or at least more comfortable, with how to treat them.
That's interesting, that analogy to prevalence with CML. I mean, there's also a smattering of people who've got checkpoint inhibitors who are living a lot longer, checkpoint plus
for sure.
Chemo. So yeah, that really is interesting. The other thing I was curious about is when you take a step back and think about lung cancer, so squamous, non-squamous slash adeno, and small cell. In general, when you think about patients with metastatic incurable disease, for each one of those three, what fraction of patients, I don't know if there's data on this or you just have sort of a global feeling you can, you know, come up with, what fractions of patients during that time towards, you know, dying from lung cancer in those three diseases do you think have significant issues with CNS mets?
I think at diagnosis, and there's a range depending on whether it's small cell or squamous cell, I think at diagnosis it's probably about 10 to 20% have brain metastases. And depending on the type of disease, it can go to 50, 60%. I think in a patient with, say, EGFR or a patient with ALK, I think the numbers go up to 50 to 60% during the course of the patient's illness.
So do you think because they're living longer or something about the biology?
I think it's because they're living longer. And they're living longer because we're controlling their systemic disease. I think, as you probably know, systemic disease has always been the life-limiting problem for most patients, even those patients with brain metastases. And so as we do a better job controlling the systemic disease, we're seeing more problems with brain metastases.
So let's go through this survey that we did of the investigators and the docs in practice and attendees. And we started out with a case. Actually, we asked Matt Gubins, who was moderating the meeting, to come up with cases from his own practice that fit into certain categories. And of course, one we wanted was a patient with a targetable mutation who had potentially stereotactic lesions that could be approached with stereotactic therapy. So he came up with a man in his 50s, metastatic adeno of the lung with EGFR19 deletion mutation, mediastinal nodes, pleura and liver, so significant systemic disease, but three asymptomatic subcentimeter lesions in the left hemisphere of the brain. We actually had the images there for everybody to take a look at. So the question is, these look like they would be amenable to something like stereotactic. Do you do stereotactic or do you go with systemic therapy? And the most common answer given by the audience was to start osimertinib in that patient and then just repeat the MRI in 4 weeks. But there was a small number, about 15-20%, who would go with some kind of stereotactic surgery. The eight investigators, you know, we ask people what they do, and if they all say they do the same thing, we call that a consensus. And that's exactly what they do. Can you talk a little bit about how you would approach a patient like this?
I think whenever you have CNS metastases and a large burden of systemic disease, you're really talking about competing risks. And if this patient has asymptomatic brain metastases, but a large burden of systemic disease, really the burden is on the patient in the systemic disease side. And so we really want to focus on that. Now, we have the added advantage in this particular situation that osimertinib can be terribly effective in the CNS. So I think we're going to give a drug that covers everything. But I would say that even if this patient didn't have an oncogene-driven cancer, I would probably start with chemotherapy, for instance, because of the systemic disease being the significant burden, the small brain metastases being a real issue, but one we can monitor as we go forward.
I'm curious, in the days when we gave chemo alone, just kidding, but it almost seems like that, what is the response rate to chemo in the brain?
I think the chemo response rate, in my estimation, is about two-thirds of what the systemic response rate is. So if, you know, say carbo-pem has a 30% response rate, we probably have a 20% response rate in the CNS.
So here's where it gets interesting, which is a slight variation of Matt's case. Exactly what you said. So basically same situation, but no systemic disease. So only in the brain. And the audience still is primarily going with osimertinib, almost the same exact numbers. And then we asked about 12 asymptomatic brain mets, bilateral, but again, no evidence of disease elsewhere. And again, even a few more people go with osimertinib. When we asked the investigator panel, it was a little bit different in that when we said the patient only had three lesions and no systemic disease, several of the investigators, including you, would go for stereotactic radiosurgery first. All the investigators with multiple bilateral brain mets would go with osimertinib. We've seen that in our polling. Can you talk about, though, that situation with just the brain mets?
Yeah, so I think one of the key factors that wasn't included in the question, but that really plays out when you think about this in clinic, is what's the patient's course of disease going to be like? And so if you have this patient with three brain metastases, and it's been 2 years since a surgery, and that's why they don't have any systemic disease, and they only have brain metastases, you can imagine that their course of disease is relatively slow. You don't know when these spots in the brain popped up. And maybe if you address those lesions with local therapy, so stereotactic radiotherapy, you can deal with them and then not have to deal with anything else for months and years to come. And then they're not on some sort of therapy. They're off systemic therapy. You know, and I think the scenario where you have 12 brain metastases is a little bit harder because then you're facing whole brain radiation. And I think most of us would like to try to avoid whole brain radiation in our patients. So for that 12 lesion case, we would approach it with systemic therapy. Whereas for the three lesions, we have the hope that this may be a little bump in the patient's course and they can get some stereotactic radiotherapy. We monitor them and, you know, we certainly expect that they'll develop additional disease, but you may be able to put that off for 6 months, a year, or even more.
What would be a period of time where you would say it's kind of quick, maybe I'll go with systemic therapy?
So 6 months to me is like an obvious time where you'd say this patient needs systemic therapy now. 2 years, it's obvious they need stereotactic radiotherapy. In the middle, I think that would be a gray zone and one we'd want to look to define.
Another thing that's interesting is for the people who would, such as you, in this kind of situation, particularly a long disease-free interval, go with stereotactic. What about post-radiation treatment, for example, osimertinib?
Yeah, I think you could do it. I think it makes sense because you'd say this patient has stage four disease, they're likely to develop disease. But at the same time, again, you know, you may be able to hold off on initiating osimertinib, and it may be 6 months that you'd be able to wait before you start the osimertinib.
There are a couple other scenarios, and then I want to just talk a little bit about the data that we have that addresses these questions. Before we get into that, just a couple more scenarios. So we presented a situation of a patient at a prior resection of an adenocarcinoma lung, exon 19 deletion, adjuvant chemo, but then presents with a single brain met. And just to kind of throw it in there, we said the PD-L1 level is 85%. So the lesion is removed surgically. And the question we asked the audience is, what about post-op radiation therapy? And there was a consensus, just kidding, they were completely split 50-50 about whether to do radiation therapy or not. When we asked the faculty, most people said they would do radiation therapy, mainly stereotactics. Any thoughts about post-resection radiation therapy?
You know, I think this is an important area, and I think, you know, local control remains critically relevant for brain metastases. So if the patient has a surgery, and then I think there are lots of factors around that surgery. And frankly, the one that leads me to answer this question most is really talking with the neurosurgeon and saying, you know, so what do you think? How'd that go? Do you think this patient needs postoperative radiation therapy? You know, if the surgeon says, got it all, I feel really comfortable, and they've got a good margin, I'm happy. They're happy to tell you when they think a little bit of postoperative radiation will help out as well. Now, clearly, I don't want to throw radiation at situations that we don't need to, because there are downsides to doing radiation. You know, I think those of us who've seen patients who've done well for a long time, we begin to see problems with radiation necrosis, and it's something that really comes up, and it can be devastating for patients. And so we clearly want to hold off on radiation when we don't need to, but at the same time, local control remains very important for brain metastases.
Not to diverge too far out, but I remember when I was watching the meeting, the issue of radiation necrosis came up, and I was thinking, how do you diagnose that?
Yeah, it's a tough one.
I mean, can you tell me about a case where you think you actually saw it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the way we see presentations are two ways. One is the routine surveillance MRI. So patients who have stereotactic radiosurgery, we typically are following those patients with brain MRIs because we want to identify new metastases and we want to make sure that we have achieved local control. Now, sometimes these things will begin to change, and our radiologists have become pretty good at seeing the changes and saying that this is recurrent tumor, or this is something that looks a little bit like radiation necrosis. Now, if it begins to change in a way that looks like radiation necrosis to my radiologist, it may also look like growth to some other radiologist. And so I think one of the mistakes we can make is seeing some changes post-stereotactic that look like growth but aren't, and then retreat that, you know, give another dose of radiation to it. And I think that can cause real trouble for the patients.
So you can make a radiologic diagnosis. Do you see like a necrotic center or something?
Yeah, there's two ways to do that. One is with the contrast, and the radiologists are pretty good at understanding the way necrosis versus tumor enhances. And then also doing brain-specific PET scans. Those can help out as well.
Maybe we could just take a breath here and talk a little bit. We talked about what kinds of actions people take in various situations. And now, so far, we've been talking about EGFR. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the data. And you actually presented a lot of that data at the meeting. I guess when I think about your presentation and the data that you talked about, the first big part of it was really reviewing what we know about TKIs in general and CNS mets. Can you kind of summarize what we know, and in particular, what we know about osimertinib compared to the prior TKIs?
Yeah. You know, I think, as I mentioned earlier, when we give chemotherapy to patients with brain metastases, we see some responses. You know, it's not no response rate, but it's a lower response rate than what we see with systemic disease. And that's the same thing we've really observed with the early generation of kinase inhibitors. So gefitinib, erlotinib, afatinib on the EGFR side, as well as crizotinib on the ALK side. Crizotinib in particular gets a bad rep for, quote, not working in the brain, but it has a CNS response rate. It does have efficacy there, but it's not as good, and neither category of drugs was as good in the CNS as it was systemically. With the newer agents, osimertinib in EGFR and alectinib, brigatinib in the ALK world, we definitely see these drugs working as well in the CNS as they are working in systemic disease. And you can see that both in the progression-free survival curves as well as waterfall plots. I think the one really nice set of data from the first line osimertinib versus EGFR trial, the FLORA trial, is a set of waterfall plots that was published as a secondary analysis down the road that compared those patients who got osimertinib to those patients who got gefitinib or erlotinib. You see that both waterfall plots look good, and if you saw the gefitinib or erlotinib waterfall plot, you'd say, oh, that looks okay, but the osimertinib waterfall plot is clearly better. You see more patients with deeper responses, and then you see the subsequent PFS curves, which really show that those patients do even better with regard to the CNS metastases. So these new generation of ALK and EGFR TKIs have really brought the CNS response rate even higher.
I guess one issue this brings up, and I can remember, I think I might have heard about this when I fellowship in oncology, is the blood-brain barrier. First of all, is there a blood-brain barrier? And what's the explanation for why osimertinib works? Is it related to the blood-brain barrier, or just that it's a better therapy?
Yeah, so the blood-brain barrier is definitely something people talk about. They continue to use this concept a lot. And this is really the idea that blood vessels in the CNS have a little bit more adhesion and a little bit more difficulty for toxins to permeate and, you know, thought to be an evolutionary advantage for our species. The concept of blood-brain barrier has been used to say that, oh, you know, some drugs don't cross the blood-brain barrier. But, you know, frankly, we have cancer cells in the brain. Somehow they crossed the blood-brain barrier. And so in these patients, typically the blood-brain barrier has been disrupted. And so I think that's less of an important concept. Now, there was a time where I said, oh, the blood-brain barrier doesn't exist. It's been disrupted for all of our patients with brain metastases. Stop talking about it. But at the same time, you know, we aren't seeing the same response rates in the CNS that we do see systemically for any of these drugs. And so I think these drugs must encounter some greater resistance to get into the CNS. By optimizing drugs to do that, the newer generation of drugs like osimertinib, alectinib, brigatinib are definitely dealing with a problem that we had.
You know, the other thing I think that you showed from that FLAURA trial was also the rates of CNS progression, which seemed like they were less in the osimertinib arm.
Yeah, I think the sort of profound thing to me is if you look at the rate of CNS progression, the hazard ratio, and the rate of systemic progression, the hazard ratio, they're exactly the same. They really show us that these drugs are equally effective in the CNS as they are systemically.
So, of course, the real question that's come about this last couple of years, and it really sparked the idea in doing this conference, was the idea that you could hold off on radiation therapy and use systemic treatment. And of course, that was particularly of interest, as you were alluding to, in terms of whole brain radiation. And even though there hasn't been a randomized trial, I see, like everybody doing it, it kind of became a de facto standard. Is that your take?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, the more we do this, the more we keep patients alive longer, the more we see the downsides of whole brain radiation therapy, the more we want to avoid that consequence for our patients.
And before we go on to the patients who don't need whole brain, a couple of points that we also put in the survey that we talked about in the meeting were a couple of strategies that have been used to decrease the adverse impact of whole brain radiation. One, hippocampal sparing, which I think is a really fascinating topic with some cool research. We asked the audience whether or not they think that helps in terms of cognitive loss, and the faculty asked them also after whole brain radiation therapy. And although a fair number of people actually were not even familiar with it, of the people who had heard about it, most of them believed that it was very helpful. And actually, a lot of these people, their patients are getting hippocampal sparing. When we asked the faculty, most of them said that they thought it was helpful and their patients are getting it, but you didn't. So can you talk a little bit about hippocampal sparing and your thoughts about it?
Yeah, so this actually, I'll tell you what, after the conference, this sparked a conversation between Dan Gomez and I, because, you know, he's the guy I would refer my patients to. And, you know, for years I've been hearing from the radiation oncologists, oh, you know, don't worry about that hippocampal sparing thing. That's not so important. But, you know, in talking with him, and he's presented some of the data on this, he feels very comfortable that hippocampal sparing is important. It's a good idea. But he also acknowledges that the majority of the time, our patients don't get hippocampal sparing radiation therapy. And the reason why we see that happen is because oftentimes when we're doing whole brain radiation therapy, it's got to be done quickly. And mapping out hippocampal sparing radiation is more challenging, takes more time, and our patients often can't wait for it. So I think I learned a lot from this conference in understanding the data around hippocampal sparing and understanding that if we give our radiation oncologists more time, they can plan that radiation and they can do it.
And, you know, from what I saw in the data that we were looking at in the conference, it looks like it does have some effect. I guess the theoretical downside that you could have escape mets in there, but I don't know, do you ever see mets there?
Right. You know, certainly are examples of hippocampal mets that happen, but that's just a small area. And I think most of us feel comfortable that if we spare that with the goal of improving long-term outcomes for our patients, we're fine with that.
I was trying to think back to med school in terms of what the hippocampus normally does. What does it do? Do you know?
Right. I think there's an important role for long-term memory, and I think that's why it was positioned as the place to try to spare.
So the other attempt to ameliorate adverse effects of whole brain that's done in some places is memantine. And we asked the audience about it, and there it doesn't seem as positive, but still maybe half the audience, their patients are getting it, which kind of I thought was interesting. Again, when we asked the faculty, actually, all three of the people up on the stage, their radiation oncs, or what, actually one of them was a rad onc, are using it. But again, you aren't. What about memantine?
Yeah, I haven't been impressed by the quality of the data. Clearly, the data that's there is suggestive of a benefit, but it's not the best quality data we've seen. But I'm open to it. But again, I think I kind of expect the rad oncs to do it. You know, if they're going to be given the radiation, I expect them to be given the memantine. But our folks have never been interested in doing that. And so I kind of thought the data wasn't very good. And when looking at it again, I'm still not very impressed by the data.
And I don't know if there are any adverse effects that can occur with the agent.
To my knowledge, there aren't, for the short term in particular.
Maybe cost, but so let's get to the real crux of the issue, which is stereotactic versus targeted therapy. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about the data we have. We don't really have great data, but what data we do have comparing those strategies?
Yeah, so some of the most prominent data is a paper from Magnuson et al. In the Journal of Clinical Oncology, the JCO. And they took patients from across a broad range of institutions who had brain metastases and looked at how they were treated. And there were three main choices for how patients were treated: stereotactic radiotherapy, whole brain, or TKI alone. And they looked at outcomes, overall survival. And what they showed is that patients who received stereotactic radiotherapy lived longer than those patients who received TKI alone or whole brain radiation therapy. So it really made TKI alone as an approach seem like an inadequate approach. My big complaint about that retrospective analysis, and some of my colleagues are co-authors on it, so it definitely included patients that I've seen and treated. But the analysis, if you look at the baseline characteristics of the patients, you see that 75% of the patients that were enrolled in that retrospective analysis had no other systemic disease. Now, this isn't a challenge that I think a lot of us face very frequently. You know, most of the time we're faced with patients who have a burden of systemic disease as well as CNS metastases. So I think, you know, that data actually does enlighten the way I approach patients who have a small number of brain metastases without systemic disease. I think stereotactic radiotherapy is clearly the right approach for those patients. But for patients with a burden of systemic disease, I think we have to deal with all that, and TKI alone can be adequate for treating those patients.
So, and I think that kind of relates to what we were talking about with these various case scenarios. But the thing that surprised me was, am I correct in saying that the patients in these studies basically didn't get osimertinib?
This is a pre-osimertinib era study.
So, like, what does it mean?
Right. For today's practice, I think it really doesn't enlighten how we treat patients.
So anyhow, yeah, I thought that was interesting. And I guess we've sort of outlined a little bit about sort of the parameters that go into these kinds of cases. But let's move on now and talk about another scenario that's not at all uncommon. And this is another case that we asked Matt for. This man in his late 40s, and adenocarcinoma of the lung, targetable lesion, in this case, an ALK translocation, extensive bone and liver mets, as is often the case. But 1.9 centimeter right temporal lesion, 4.1 centimeter frontoparietal lesion, both with significant edema. However, the patient was asymptomatic. So the question is, what would you do with a patient like that? The audience was kind of split, a little bit more going for systemic therapy with alectinib. So when we asked the faculty, they were kind of split between surgery and alectinib. And I think you had down there neurosurgery. Does that sound right?
Yeah. You know, I think large tumors like this, you can clearly get into trouble very quickly. Even though this patient's asymptomatic, a 4-centimeter metastasis is a large metastasis and one I really feel like we need to deal with. The use of an ALK TKI in this context is, of course, you know, great, and you're going to see a response most of the time. I'm going to say 70% of the time we're going to see a great response. But when you have something so big in that context, I would go for neurosurgery, if it's safe, of course, because I think that you're going to have the best outcome for the patient. Now, of course, in the real world, these decisions are not completely separate. And you may start the patient on alectinib and send them to the neurosurgeon. And the neurosurgeon will see them and they'll plan the surgery for a few days later. And, you know, maybe they've gotten a few days of alectinib prior and, you know, you'll begin the process of shrinking the cancer. But you give yourself a safety margin, a little bit more comfort by taking out the brain metastasis. And of course, the other thing to emphasize is that since it's so large, the 4-centimeter lesion, it's harder to do stereotactic radiosurgery for a tumor like that. There's clear data that the larger the tumor, the lower the local control rate, and the larger the tumor, the higher the rate of radiation necrosis. So for a big tumor like this, neurosurgery is the way to go, if it can be safely done.
Incidentally, we were talking about radionecrosis before. Do you use anything to treat it? Corticosteroids, anything?
So steroids are the first line treatment for radiation necrosis. And if you can turn things around quickly with that, then you're in a good spot. But of course, steroids have long-term challenges. And so if a patient has persistent symptoms of radiation necrosis, then we sometimes will use bevacizumab. There are NCCN recommendations to use bevacizumab. And so typically we can get it reimbursed and there's some value in that.
So we asked a bunch of scenarios similar to the EGFR scenarios we just went through with ALK and got very, very similar answers. So from your point of view, do you think the paradigm with ALK and EGFR and management of brain mets is about the same?
Yeah, I think it really is the same. Both with EGFR and ALK, we've seen development of the latest TKIs that we're currently using as first-line drugs with TKIs that work well in the CNS. So they're parallel therapeutic options, so I think we take parallel strategies.
So I'm curious, there are obviously a whole bunch of other targetable lesions in lung cancer, you know, BRAF, ROS1, there's a long list. How do they fit into this paradigm?
Yeah, these are tougher to sort out because we have a lot less data. You know, for instance, for BRAF mutant patients, we don't have as much information about the CNS efficacy of dabrafenib and trametinib. I would suspect it's okay, and I would often take that TKI first approach for such a patient, but I'd be a little bit more anxious, and I'd be doing that MRI pretty quickly, 3-4 weeks after starting, so I made sure that things were headed in the right direction.
You know, when I think about the genomic alterations that will cause investigators to use targeted therapy upfront, and we're not seeing randomized trials on that much anymore when people are just sort of flipping to it. I hear people saying BRAF. I hear people saying ROS1. Now people saying RET. Maybe exon 14, not sure. What are the lesions right now? Let's just, before we get to the brain part of it, what are the alterations where you usually use targeted therapy? Let's say the patient's not that symptomatic.
I would say that in the minimally symptomatic patient with an oncogene-driven cancer, I'm always going to try to start with a TKI. What data we have really supports the idea that, you know, even in some of these less common ones, say MET exon 14, if you look at the data, the patients who got these TKIs in the first line did better than those patients who got it in the second and third line. And so I think, you know, I'd like to use the TKI up front if we can, because frankly, the response rates are better. The response rates remain better than we see with chemotherapy. Now, we have to develop better drugs in these spaces, and I think MET exon 14 is the perfect example. You know, the initial data with crizotinib are certainly impressive. They certainly show that MET exon 14 is an oncogene-driven cancer, but it shows that, you know, the response rate is kind of lousy with crizotinib. It's in the 30-35% range, and we need to do better.
When we did the year in review series this past fall, when we got to the section with targeted therapy, where we got into new TKIs, you know, for exon 20 insertion, all this, you know, I felt like I was teaching a course in another language. I mean, I think in the space of 10 minutes, I went through a dozen new drugs that looked like really good drugs.
That's right. And some of them don't have names yet, but they're still exciting for these oncogene-driven cancers. And, you know, I think we all thought, you know, 15 years ago when EGFR came out, we thought that might just be a flash in the pan. And then we came up with ALK, and they thought, oh, something more to this. And then it's just sort of been like a drumbeat over the last 10 years. We've seen newer and newer targets, drugs that target those things. It's an exciting time for sure.
when I get to that part, now I warn the oncologist. So, you know, just like, get ready, here it comes, you know. So I'm going to say maybe one exception to your rule in terms of targeted therapy might be HER2.
I think you're right. That is a good example of an exception. We have very modest data on HER2. Best data we have is using the T-DM1 antibody, atotrastuzumab emtansine, which is a drug often used in breast cancer, but there's some modest data to suggest its value in lung cancer. The response rates, again, are low, around 40%, but the confidence intervals are wide given that we've only treated on study maybe 20 patients or less. So I think there's a lot more to learn there, and we clearly need better kinase inhibitors in that space. The T-DM1, although it's valuable, isn't the drug we want to start with.
So I meant to ask you, when you're talking about ALK and response rates that are seen in terms of first-line therapy, that it looks like everybody's, at least in these CNS scenarios, is putting down alectinib, but you do have two other drugs out there, brigatinib and ceritinib. You know, there's this issue with the pulmonary reaction with brigatinib that seems like people aren't that concerned about, but do you think it would be equally valid to use those two drugs for CNS mets?
I think brigatinib is clearly equal to alectinib. Everything we see suggests these drugs are almost exactly the same. So I think brigatinib and alectinib are really on par. Now, ceritinib, you know, ceritinib is kind of a funny drug. It entered the market at a good time, so we had an opportunity to use it after patients had progressed on crizotinib, but it had some GI toxicities. So then there was some revamping, and we got a new dose, and patients take it with food, so that's helped a lot with GI toxicity. But, you know, it's probably not quite as good as alectinib in the CNS, and there was a paper published a few years back of patients who were progressing on ceritinib who then went on to alectinib, and we saw multiple patients with response in that context. And we think it really is due to better CNS penetration of alectinib versus ceritinib. So I think ceritinib's probably not quite as good a drug as alectinib or brigatinib.
Another general issue about the CNS mets is the issue of edema. So how much edema does it take if an asymptomatic patient, do you want to do something about it, treat the patient, for example?
You know, I think edema plays a role in your decision-making when you have a drug that's minimally effective. And so for the example of a patient who we're going to treat with just chemotherapy alone, carbapenem, something like that, you know, for a variety of reasons that might come up. If that patient's got edema, if that patient has a few brain metastases, I probably will send them to the radiation oncologist because I'm a little bit more worried about that edema. Now, of course, the way we treat that is we give them dexamethasone, and typically that edema resolves pretty quickly. But to me, it's a sign that this cancer is a bit more active, that the reactions can be more troublesome.
So another issue, when we started asking these questions, for example, the first one we worked with a few years ago, the bilateral brain met situation and a targetable lesion, we always made the patient asymptomatic because that's what we were hearing from you. But then we started to hear these cases where there were like little symptoms, like a little numbness in the arm, not too much. So how much symptomatology would it take to push you towards whole brain radiation, for example?
In a patient with an oncogene-driven cancer, I'm not going to let that sway me. Because I typically, if we give that patient dexamethasone, we reverse those symptoms pretty quickly. And the efficacy of TKIs, osimertinib, alectinib, brigatinib, is adequate for most patients. And so I still feel, even in a symptomatic patient, I'm going to get them asymptomatic, typically with steroids, and then I'm going to start TKI.
That's really interesting. Another scenario we asked about that I thought was kind of interesting, I'm not exactly surprised, but we never really asked it before, is a patient with metastatic disease, EGFR mutant, who's responding to osimertinib, we've said 18 months, but then develops a new brain met. Everything else is the same. And it's interesting because the audience and the faculty apply, I guess it's really the HER2 breast cancer. I saw this as a consensus statement with HER2 positive brain mets, where they treat the brain mets, but they keep the anti-HER therapy going. It looks like that model has been applied to osimertinib.
Yeah, you know, I think we've actually been pushing this idea for a while for oncogene-driven cancers. And really, it's a subset of what we define as oligoprogression, you know. So Disease is largely controlled, but we have a single site that has escaped and has begun growing and become resistant. Now, we don't know the mechanism of resistance in a single site, but if we can treat that single site with radiation, whether it's in the CNS or in the lung, I'm fully supportive of that approach. Now, I think the CNS is a particularly good subset to treat that way because this blood-brain barrier concept that we talked about means that there's sometimes a little bit less drug there and resistance can happen sooner there. So you're going to buy yourself more time with a brain metastasis compared to, say, a lung metastasis.
We want to talk also a little bit about leptomeningeal disease and the use of targeted therapy in that situation. By way of background, again, can you talk a little bit about the incidence of leptomeningeal disease and the therapies we've had in the past for it?
Yeah, so leptomeningeal disease at presentation is pretty uncommon. I would say it happens in 1 or 2% of our patients with lung cancer, whether it's oncogene-driven or not. But as we talked about earlier, when we are able to control systemic disease for a long time, patients often end up with CNS metastases and that subset of CNS metastases, leptomeningeal disease. And I think the frequency with which those come up is still pretty low. I'm going to estimate on the order of 10%, maybe 20% overall, but we definitely see it.
And can you talk a little bit about what we know right now about the use of targeted therapy and its efficacy in patients with leptomeningeal disease? It seems like most of what I've seen, at least in terms of targeted therapy, has been EGFR and osimertinib, but I don't know, maybe there's a lot of other stuff too.
Yeah, the published data is largely around osimertinib, and I think this is a great frustration of those of us who treat leptomeningeal disease is because we just don't have as much data as we'd like. And if you have this conversation, I think we've had this conversation before, talking about how you treat leptomeningeal disease, there's still a large group of people who treat with intrathecal chemotherapy. There's a group of people who recommend whole brain radiation therapy. And there's a group of people who recommend systemic therapy. And none of us have enough data to support our argument and tell anybody that the other argument is wrong. I personally favor systemic therapy as my approach to leptomeningeal disease because I feel like none of the local options, so intrathecal chemotherapy or whole brain radiation therapy, are adequate to treat what is, in a sense, systemic disease within the CNS. We have a broad range of cancer cells floating around through the spinal column, around the CNS. It's not a single spot that can be dealt with just a spot of radiation.
So Matt Gubins had a patient, early 40s, metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung, EGFR LA58R, response of first-line osimertinib for 2 years, but then develops two new asymptomatic punctate parenchymal mets and extensive leptomeningeal involvement. No evidence of disease elsewhere. The audience is really split. Some of them say that they would go for whole brain radiation. Others would double the dose of osimertinib. And really, that's the two choices the faculty makes. But more commonly, a lot of the faculty would double the dose. And again, you're kind of you like to be creative, huh? So we have, again, all the 8 faculty members either double the dose or do whole brain, but you say continue at 80, but add carbapenem plus or minus Bev?
Right. And so I think, I would say that doubling the osimertinib is certainly a reasonable approach. Obviously, I have smart colleagues who recommend that approach. And so I think that can be done. And of course, the basis for using 160 in leptomeningeal disease is a study called the Bloom study, which is an extraordinarily small study, less than 20 patients in that study. And all the patients had leptomeningeal disease. They were treated with 160 of osimertinib. And they saw many patients have a clinical response and some even have a clearance of cancer cells from the CSF. So it's an approach that's reasonable. But of course, we don't have the same data in patients who were given 80 milligrams of osimertinib. And I think much of what we talk about is the great efficacy in the CNS of 80 milligrams of osimertinib. And so I don't think that that's going to get you very far by simply doubling the dose. It's certainly a reasonable strategy. But I think if this patient has not had platinum-based doublet chemotherapy, I think you're going to get some benefit from going with that approach, is really amping up your systemic therapy approach by adding chemotherapy. And there is some notion that adding bevacizumab can help with CNS penetration of these drugs. And so I typically would try to do carbapenem-bev in this context. Now, that being said, I've had examples, a patient in my practice who had been through platinum doublet chemotherapy, had been through docetaxel, and she was progressing on osimertinib with bad leptomeningeal disease. I gave 160 milligrams of osimertinib, and she had a dramatic clinical response. Now, that dramatic clinical response only lasted about 6 months, but it was dramatic, and it was very helpful in that situation.
That's really interesting. Sometimes you hear one case, and it's enough to make you think. Another thing that's kind of interesting, we asked both the audience and the faculty, in a patient who hasn't had targeted therapy, but they have leptomeningeal disease, I know that's very uncommon, but we were just kind of curious what dose people would use. The audience, actually a third of them would use 160, but for the faculty, all but one would just use 80, kind of echoing what you just said. What were the actual response rates seen in the Bloom study, and have you seen patients who had clinical responses, symptomatology improve?
Yeah, I've definitely seen clinical improvement with osimertinib in patients with leptomeningeal disease. And, you know, I think it's like the gratifying responses that we often see with TKIs as upfront therapy. You know, somebody who has cough and it goes away a week later with simple single agent osimertinib. We see that same sort of thing when patients get either 80 or 160 of osimertinib in patients with EGFR mutant disease and leptomeningeal disease. We see those funny symptoms they have, you know, either dizziness or numbness, tingling that roves about, all those sorts of funny symptoms that we associate with leptomeningeal disease. We see dramatic responses.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the symptoms, and you hear stories about cranial nerves, et cetera. Is it generally a challenge to make the diagnosis?
You know, I think the way I make that diagnosis is, you know, you think about CNS metastases, you think about their symptoms, and you think about how you would approach this. Oftentimes, they're coming in with a somewhat atypical complaint. You know, it'll be this, again, sort of numbness on the side of their face, or their eye isn't working right. In your first response as an oncologist is you're going to send that patient for a brain MRI. But the brain MRI is either going to show you what you expect, some leptomeningeal disease or a spot, or sometimes it's not. And in those cases where it's getting a little harder, you don't see clear radiographic evidence of lepto on the brain MRI, then you might do a spine MRI, because spine MRIs can also pick up the evidence of leptomeningeal disease. And then finally, if you still can't quite figure this out, this is the time to bring in a neuro-oncologist or just do a lumbar puncture and assess for metastases. Now, of course, leptomeningeal disease, the yield rate for cytology on CSF is relatively low. And so the kind of conventional teaching that you're going to want to do three LPs to make sure that they're negative, certainly that applies. But I think the pretest probability for most of our patients going in to an LP because we think they might have lepto is pretty high. And I would say that the yield is actually pretty decent on that first lumbar puncture.
So the last thing I want to ask you about, and actually I was even as interested in seeing the results of this one as all the stuff we've talked to up to now, is a patient without targetable lesions, but with a high TPS score, PD-L1 level. So we presented a couple of cases. Actually, one was Matt's case, a patient who had a TPS of 80%, no targetable lesions, woman in her late 60s, one centimeter asymptomatic MET and superior vermis. So, you know, kind of a stereotactic type model, similar to what we were talking about before, but wondering whether with this high TPS score, people will sort of shift into the targeted model. And it actually kind of looks similar results, a little bit more stereotactic surgery, but quite a number of people, almost half in the pre-meeting survey of the audience and oncologists who would use pembrolizumab in that situation. When we asked the faculty, there was more orientation around stereotactic radiation surgery. That was the answer you gave. Maybe people not as comfortable with that model. But then the one I really wanted to see was the 12 asymptomatic brain mets that was going to require whole brain radiation. Still, 40% of the audience says they'll use whole brain radiation, but the rest would use pembro or pembro plus chemo. When we asked the faculty, most of the faculty says pembrolizumab, either alone or with chemotherapy, and that's what you said. I'm guessing you might have done this, have you?
Yeah, certainly this comes up from time to time. And I think the real drive, again, is we want to try to avoid whole brain if we can. We don't like those toxicities, both short-term and long-term, and we'd like to try something that avoids that. We know that pembrolizumab in a patient with a very high TPS has a really good response rate, but it's not quite as good as what we see with TKIs. It's probably in the 50% range for a patient with a very high TPS score. So I think we all believe that pembrolizumab can be effective. We've seen it be effective in the CNS, and so I think we feel comfortable giving it a try when the downside of not trying, of giving whole brain radiation therapy is pretty big.
What do we know about responsiveness to brain mets with PD-1 therapy and PD-1 therapy with chemotherapy?
Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen the initial data for single-agent pembrolizumab, as well as the combination chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab data. But we don't have as much information about CNS efficacy. And I think that's largely because of the way the trials were designed. Those trials prohibited patients with CNS metastases from enrolling. And so we have to look at sort of more boutique trials. And the one example that we often show is from Dr. Goldberg at Yale. And she enrolled patients with brain metastases, either from non-small cell lung cancer or melanoma, and gave them pembrolizumab. And she saw gratifying responses in a significant number of patients. So that tells us these drugs work there. Whether they're quite as good as they are systemically, I think, remains to be seen, and we need to learn a little bit more about it.
We're hearing a lot of excitement from the melanoma people about ipi/nivo specifically in brain mets, and of course they use it a lot just in metastatic disease. Any reason to think that might be better in lung cancer? In the brain.
I think the role for ipi/nivo generally is a little bit unclear right now. We certainly have seen some positive data to support its use, and I haven't seen enough data to say whether it might be useful in the brain, but I certainly look forward to seeing more.
Any thoughts about where we might be 5 years from now in terms of what we've been talking about today, targeted therapy in general and specifically as relates to CNS mets?
I hope that the path we've seen with TKIs continues and that the drugs that we're using are more and more effective in the CNS. I think, the ALK space provides an example where we have excellent CNS penetration and CNS efficacy of both alectinib and brigatinib. But when patients progress on those, we have lorlatinib, another drug, which seems to even penetrate the CNS better and be more effective in that context. So as we learn how these drugs work, we can maybe move them into the first line. There's a trial comparing lorlatinib to crizotinib as first-line therapy for ALK-positive disease. But I have to recognize also that lorlatinib comes with some toxicities that's probably a result of its penetration of the CNS. It causes a little bit of forgetfulness in some patients. These are dose-dependent. You adjust the dose and you can manage that. But we may end up hitting a therapeutic window where drugs that get into the CNS really well may cause more problems in the CNS. But I think TKIs as therapy for oncogene-driven cancers will remain a cornerstone of the care of these patients. And I hope that we can see a lot more data to show us that immunotherapy works in the CNS well.
Lorlatinib, is that the one that causes edema?
It sure can cause edema, cause a little bit of forgetfulness, can cause some balance issues rarely.
Wow, that's so CNS effects. Interesting.
Yeah.
What about the future, if any? I was really surprised to even hear about this, of combining a TKI and chemo. And there's a couple trials out there that look pretty I was like, whoa.
Yeah, this is strikingly a hot area, and these trials have been occurring on the periphery and people haven't been talking about them too much. One of the big trials came from Japan. One of the other big trials came from India. But both of these trials have shown that adding chemotherapy to TKI as initial treatment can improve progression-free survival, and there's evidence that improves overall survival. I think the data that we have are markedly different. So the Indian trial, the overall survival is less than 2 years for the combination arm, but the Japanese trial, the overall survival is approaching 5 years for patients who got the combination of erlotinib plus chemotherapy. So I think we have a lot to learn, and there are ongoing trials that are beginning to look at this worldwide, and I think it's an exciting area. Now, one of the appeals of TKIs that when a patient is diagnosed, then we can give them pill-based therapy and they can do well without systemic chemotherapy. But I think we're also beginning to see that this has its limits in terms of effectiveness. And if we can, you know, combine approaches, as we learned long ago in lymphoma and leukemia, if you combine drugs with different mechanisms of action, you can improve outcomes for our patients. So I think we're conceptually based on that. And I think this is an exciting time where we begin to combine things. Now, most of this TKI plus chemo data isn't with osimertinib, the ones that are published and available. So it's a little bit harder to know how that all fits into common practice today. But in terms of designing trials, it really gives a path forward for how we design the next generation of trials with osimertinib.
Yeah, I remember that initial randomized trial, the IPASS study, that compared chemo to TKI that showed that TKI was better. I guess what would have been interesting is there was a third arm that had both together. And I guess the other thought is, if for an oncologist who maybe reads about this strategy, gets excited about it, I'm guessing the idea of TKI, chemo, and anti-PD-1 may be not something you would support.
Well, I think the biggest challenge is that TKIs plus PD-1 have variable toxicity concerns.
Right.
And in particular, osimertinib, we've seen, has a pretty high rate of pulmonary toxicity when you combine it with durvalumab that was done in a prospective trial. And all of the TKIs have sort of idiosyncratic side effects, where maybe you see higher rates of LFTs, maybe you see a variety of other immune-related adverse events at a higher frequency. So it's a little bit dicey at the moment. I think it's not ready for daily practice today to combine an anti-PD-1, PD-L1 antibody with a TKI today.
Yeah, I heard about the thing combining it and there being a problem. But the other thing I heard about more recently that I've been hearing a lot of people talk about, I'm not sure if you were involved in getting this data, was looking at people who got TKIs after previously receiving an IO.
Yeah, so this is, I think, one of the published series is from one of my colleagues, Adam Schoenfeld, and this looked at patients who, you know, you face that clinical situation where you don't know their EGFR status, so you give them pembrolizumab or you give them chemo plus pembrolizumab, and then you come up with the EGFR mutation result 6 weeks or 8 weeks later, and then you try to figure out what to do. And, you know, based on this idea that the TKIs are better, many docs would just switch immediately to the TKI. But of course, we all know that these antibodies linger in the system for a long time, and they have half-lives of 2-3 months sometimes. And so that's essentially a combination treatment for those patients. And we saw the attendant side effects. In this series, there was, I think, a 25% rate of grade 3-4 immune-related adverse events, much higher than what you'd expect with single-agent pembrolizumab.
You know, I was wondering, too, you know, the patients are getting consolidation or durvalumab after chemoradiation therapy. And people are doing that for people who have targetable lesions, right?
Right, exactly.
So then, so
if those patients recur quickly or during the radiation or during that year of durvalumab, we could run into trouble. The one approach that I've thought about and I've recommended to a few folks, though I haven't actually done it myself, is to say that the data of combining erlotinib plus some of the anti-PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies is okay. So erlotinib plus pembrolizumab or erlotinib plus durvalumab is okay in terms of toxicity. And so I might start that particular patient with erlotinib should they have recurrent disease during that course of durvalumab.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Riley and to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio spinoff program from the 2019 Society of Neuro-Oncology Annual Meeting.